On Wednesday, December 18th, Joe was joined by Professor of Political Science at Hartwick College in Oneonta, who studies gender and politics, women political candidates, women voters, and women in elected office, Laurel Elder, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, an advanced lead for the White House and former Chief of Staff for State Senator Michelle Hinchey, and former Assistant County Executive for Pat Ryan, Anna Markowitz, and Albany Law School Professor Sarah Rogerson.
Trump and his lawyers are going to use any legal claim that they can think of, that they can think has a chance of sticking. They'll cast a wide net to carry out the vendetta. Many of Mr. Trump's lawsuits go nowhere, including one that accused Hillary Clinton and a group of other Democrats of being part of a racketeering conspiracy against him. But last week, and this is really where it all begins, at least in this current cycle, last week, ABC News settled a defamation lawsuit filed against the network by Mr. Trump for $15 million. This is for comments made by a reporting done by George Stephanopoulos on ABC News's This Week. Along with another $1 million in legal fees, it is a huge sum. I mean, not for Disney, but it's a huge sum, and one that appears to have emboldened the incoming president. The latest legal action came on Monday when Mr. Trump filed a lawsuit against pollster Ann Selzer. You may remember that her polling firm, the Des Moines Register, and Gannett, the newspaper's parent company, put in a poll shortly before the election that showed Ms. Harris leading in Iowa by 3 points. So now the president-elect is accusing not only Ms. Selzer, but the Des Moines Register and Gannett of brazen election interference. Mr. Trump won the state handily, as he has in the past. On Monday at a news conference in Florida, Mr. Trump previewed the lawsuit, which is already in process of being drafted. "I have to do it," he said. "We have to straighten out the press." Laurel.
Well, I think this story is really important because of the very basic point that free press, free media is so essential to our democracy. It is, of course, how people know what our government and our elected officials are doing. And it's how government officials and other powerful interests are held to account. I teach a course, actually, on media and politics. I'm teaching it this spring, and interestingly, it's like over-enrolled, very popular, even though it's at 8 a.m. Maybe the students think we're going to just watch TikToks all semester. We're not. That's not the plan. But anyway, on the first page of my syllabus is a quote from Thomas Jefferson, and it's something from, you know, he wrote a lot about the free press, but he said, "If we were to have a government without a free press or a free press without a government, I would choose the latter." And all that just to underscore how critical this role of a free press is and always has been in our democracy and in all democracies. I'll also say that President Trump and, you know, soon to be President Trump, and he's not alone in really disliking his media coverage. All presidents, Democratic presidents, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Joe Biden, for sure, have not liked the way the news media has covered them. They think it's unfair, overly critical, doesn't give them credit for their achievements. So this is kind of normal. But what's unusual, of course, is the language that Trump has used to go after the news media and then actually taking legal action against the news media. And of course, this is a concern. Even if his lawsuits are not successful, and it's sort of interesting that the one against ABC News was as successful as it was, but even if they're not, and there's good reason to think that it might not be, this could still be really intimidating and for the press. Fighting lawsuits is expensive and it's time consuming. And with a few exceptions, a lot of news organizations are not in a robust financial position to be fighting these kind of disputes.
Am I the only one that's getting like real Russia vibes here? Mm-hmm. Like in 2022, Putin had a new law that he signed into effect that essentially made it illegal for the press to say, you just spread false information, and anything that was false was essentially anything that was against what he wanted. And I just feel like this is really out of that playbook, where he's President Trump is now setting a precedent that if you speak out and you say something that is contradictory to his liking, that he's going to take you to court and bring the law involved. And, you know, even if there isn't a law that specifically makes this illegal to do, he has the Supreme Court. He has a lot of power in this arena. And so I think it's not a great way to be going.
Well, for a man who hates so many people, I think it's going to take him a long time to sue everybody. Because his quote was that even though he lost the case, he made somebody's life miserable, and that's what he's all about. And this was a woman who published a timely polling outcome at a time, I think it was like the week before the election, that in a critical state. So it's like a political enemy situation. I'm reminded that this happened before. Trump's lawyers tried to sue the New York Times when he ran the last time. And in 2016, David McCraw, I promise I'm not advertising for Albany Law School all morning, but he's on our board of trustees and he's counsel at New York Times. And I teach this letter in my class because it's such a great example of effective legal writing. He responded to this crap lawsuit that demanded that the New York Times take down information about the allegations against Trump and his sexual assault bucket of claims. I mean, there's so many. But the last paragraph reads, and I give David a lot of credit for this. It's just a page letter. He didn't respond with dozens of documents. He said, "We did what the law allows. We published newsworthy information about a subject of deep public concern. If Mr. Trump disagrees, if he believes that the American citizens had no right to hear what these women had to say, and that the law of this country forces us and those who would dare to criticize him to stand silent or be punished, we welcome the opportunity to have a court set him straight." And I feel like, you know, I've as an immigration lawyer, I've often been at the opposite end of the law of Donald Trump and his policies, actually for years. And he's a bully. So you respond to a bully with clear, concise, forceful responses. The point is well taken that, like, the Des Moines Register probably doesn't have the ammunition that the New York Times has.
I want to hear, Bob, from you, but it seems silly. I mean, when you think about it, that it is a poll. And it is we always say polls are snapshots and from that moment. And to then say that, and by the way, I will say pretty much for the record, on the record, this woman she has since resigned and stepped down, and I understand. But a respected poller, a greatly respected pollster, mm-hmm. To then that it is, it's one poll.
Well,
it's hardly election interference.
But Joe, so I push back and say that actually it's brilliant. Okay, because think about what it does. Okay, first, he's found a way to funnel more money into his pocket.
Yep.
Okay, so the caving of ABC, of, you know, ABC, in addition to the $15 million, they covered $1 million of his attorney's fees. So don't forget that. But what we're talking about in
so they'll actually get paid.
Yes. Well, so if he passes it on. What I think we're looking at though is it's extortion at the presidential level. Is that, you know, besides funneling money into it, basically what he's doing is he's starting to threaten anybody who is going to question his policies or positions. And the fear of intimidation isn't just the fact that you've got a rich guy with no common sense and lots of attorneys. It's now that you've got a rich guy with the levers of government behind it. And if you're going to start to call into question how he's operating, how he's funneling money, how he's changing the country, you're going to have to be prepared both criminally and civilly to be able to do it. So he's sending a very clear message to any of the media outlets that would call into question what he's doing as president or how he's running his presidency. So this is, to me, is a very brilliant move. And getting ABC to cave just starts the stampede of I think, other cases. And again, he gets to hoover more money into his pocket. He gets to shut down in some ways, or at least make any press or influencer think twice about questioning what he does. And he's redefining this idea of what rights are.
Talking about President-elect Trump and his relationship with the media, and by suing the Des Moines Register and the recent settlement with ABC, escalating threats against the media and several other actions being taking place or being considered, I should say, by the president-elect against media. I believe the next one up is CBS News. He has sued CBS News in federal court in Texas, alleging that 60 Minutes engaged in deceptive trade practices when it aired an interview with Ms. Harris. And so this is, he has called the press the enemy of the people. So before we went to the break, I asked the question of, would we be in this situation if ABC didn't? And I am going to use the word cave.
I think ABC's decision to settle for $15 million is really, it's puzzling. I think most legal experts in this area, there's a very strong precedent. There's a 1964 unanimous Supreme Court case, New York Times versus Sullivan, that basically said in order to win a libel case, as Trump was alleging in this case, if you are a public figure, so someone who is chosen to run for high-level public office or something else like that, it's a very high bar that you have to overcome to win your case. You have to show that the news organization or the reporter in this case, the news personality, George Stephanopoulos, knew what he was saying was untrue and said it anyway, or showed reckless disregard for the truth. And in many, you know, people say because of the quirks of New York state law that George Stephanopoulos may have misspoke when he was talking about the outcome of the Jean Carroll case with Donald Trump. But it was, you know, pretty minor. They could have made a correction and probably had a strong ability to win this case. And so it's sort of a puzzle to many people. I guess, you know, why they would have decided to settle and for such a large amount.
Yeah. He did say it four times on the air, but I do understand it certainly could have been corrected. Anna?
I mean, I personally wonder how long would this case have taken if they brought it to court? How much in legal fees would they have spent? Was this just an effort to just be done with it and they didn't really think about the precedent that they were setting? But I think it does set a really bad precedent, and I think it emboldens him to take this tactic moving forward. And so now we're going to see press being more afraid to come out and say how they feel. And I think that we're really moving in the wrong direction. And he's using other similar intimidation tactics to get his picks through the confirmation process with Pete Hegseth. You know, they're using the media and they're using other fear tactics to get people to kind of fall in line. And so I think that we're seeing this pattern and we're going to see it in many areas moving forward.
So I appreciate the raising the issue of the Sullivan case because you know, that is a precedent, even though it was a unanimous Supreme Court decision that Clarence beep beep let's go Arvine Thomas has identified as part of his hit list of issues he would like to see rolled back because he didn't like the criticism that he has personally received. So I mean there is that interesting dynamic that I hadn't really thought about, that this may be starting to try to create a glide path for a test of Sullivan by what I still consider to be the most illegitimate Supreme Court that we've had in recent history. I would also note that if this is the standard that press is going to be held to, what about Fox? I mean, come on. And I disillusioned with ABC, and I will admit that I don't pay a lot of attention to them anyway, so it's not like they're going to lose a big supporter. But this is something that I think they have had an obligation to fight, and they didn't, and they decided that it was easier to cave. But when they're caving, they're giving away a little bit of their money, but they're giving away our rights. And I think that's what I find most offensive about this, is that free press is only free if the press is also going to be a zealous guardian of those rights. And you look at you talked about the LA Times, you talked about the Washington Post. What we didn't talk about is the fact that then Bezos has turned around and donated $1 million to the I Love You, Donald campaign.
The inauguration,
and you start to look at it, and you go, "Are any of you going to hold this man accountable?" And it certainly looks less and less likely that the press is going to do what it should be doing.
That was Robert Griffin on the roundtable panel on Wednesday, December 18th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, December 19th, Joe was joined by publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, preceptor in public speaking for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, and vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
Republicans scrapped House Speaker Mike Johnson's bipartisan plan to avert a government shutdown as President-elect Trump and Elon Musk joined a broad swath of the the House GOP on Wednesday to condemn a compromise bill that included a Democratic policy priority. The rebuke, which built steadily through the day and culminated with a long written statement from Trump in the late afternoon, has forced Johnson back to the drawing board on a plan to prevent a Christmastime shutdown and maintain the support of his chaotic conference to be reelected as Speaker early next year. Your elected representatives have heard you, and now the terrible bill is dead, Musk boasted on X, the social media site he owns, after he spent the day blasting the legislation. The voice of the people has triumphed. He triumphed. Johnson has not outlined a backup plan, and multiple people familiar with the real-time conversation said the next step remains unclear, as leaders would need significant support from both parties and Trump to pass a funding extension. House Majority Leader Steve Scalise of Louisiana said Wednesday night that there was no new agreement and that the Republicans were, quote, just looking at a number of options. If Congress does not extend the deadline, most federal operations would shut down at 12:01 Saturday, though the effects of a shutdown wouldn't fully kick in until Monday.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, and blessings to all. Well, you're here in the flesh, so we'll let you start off first.
I was hoping we could start off on a positive note, but I guess we're not going to be able to
do
that.
Well, you find one, and I'll do it. I don't...
You know, it's... I think it's a sign of things to come. This is what we're going to be looking at for at least the next 4 years, this kind of chaos. The wealthiest man in the world is now in a position to control what our elected officials do, apparently. Apparently, our elected officials don't have the guts to stand up and actually do what they're elected to do. They're reporting to President-elect Musk, is what I think we should start calling him, actually. It's amazing that the actual president-elect, who isn't even president yet, has this much power. It's amazing that the richest man in the world has this much power. One of the things that I found strange about the story, but I guess understandable knowing Trump, is that he wants them to both not pass a spending bill, which he claims to be terrible, which is really just because he doesn't want the Democrats or Joe Biden to get any credit for anything. And he also wants them to raise the debt ceiling at the same time. So he wants to reduce spending and increase the mechanism that allows you to spend a lot more all at the same time. And all of that I find to be quite remarkable. He doesn't want to take credit. He doesn't want to have to raise the debt ceiling, which he knows he'll have to do. He wants Joe Biden to do it. This is a mess because they're not going to be able to get anything passed without Democratic support because they don't have the numbers to do that. So any changes they make to this bill are likely to turn off Democrats and probably some Republicans, too. There are things in this bill that both Democrats and Republicans want. There are things in this bill that the American people desperately need to survive. And it is a mess that is being created by primarily, I think, a person who really has no idea how government works, has no understanding of real policy, and that would be Elon Musk.
The other thing, too, is that you have Mike Johnson, who's working not only to come up with a plan, but ultimately to save his job and to find the Republican support, even within his own conference, to stay as the Speaker of the House. Judy.
Yeah, this would be hilarious if it didn't have such real-world consequences. And again, Trump's move to increase the debt ceiling, it is so classic. You know, he wants it on Biden's watch, and then he doesn't have to take the blame for it once he gets into office. I mean, the kinds of things that were added to this bill that people are objecting to or what scuttled it include a lot of money for farmers, some money for child care, extension of child care benefits, $25 million to increase protection for Supreme Court justices' houses, an increase in pay for members of Congress. They get about $160. It would go up to about an increase of $6,000 or $7,000. The kinds of things that can get bipartisan support are being drawn into question. I didn't think Mike Johnson was going to have this trouble in terms of retaining his job heading into the new administration. But wow, this is the question is, should Democrats just sit back and let the Republicans devolve into crisis, or they should they step forward and try to keep the government running? It's a really interesting quandary they face. And in terms of what's going to happen in 2 years, they have some strategic decisions to make.
Ira Fussville.
You know, I heard Terry referenced it. I heard it last night for the first time. I may be late on this, but one of the guests on one of the talk show referred to Musk as President Musk and Trump as Vice President. And I wonder, A, if that is widespread, and B, if it starts sticking, at what point in time will Trump say, no, this is not, my ego will not allow that. So something to watch for about the potential of a rift between Musk and Trump. And again, I agree with you. This is a preview of coming attractions. We're going to see, I don't know, based on the current configuration of the legislatures, there's no reason to think that these kinds of fights are going to continue on. And Trump obviously knows that, which is why I think he wants to raise the debt limit, so that there's less chance that these arguments will occur every X number of months. But I just sort of say we ought to brace ourselves because we're going to be facing it. And I the last time I was here, I said I'm trying not to get upset about the incoming Trump administration. Every time somebody says something, we get wound up. I said, did you see what they did now? I'm just trying to take it easy, and let's see how this evolves. I would ask Judy, the items that you listed, Do you agree that those things should be funded this way, or do you believe, as I do to a certain extent, that this is just pork barrel stuff?
Well, I don't know if it's pork barrel. I think it's probably valuable spending, but I don't think I think the way to fund government is to have real discussions and hearings and make decisions on funding on their merits, not as a political patronage or political back and forth. I know that's not how it works, but that's ideally how I would like to see it made. I mean, a lot of the some of this money is disaster relief funding for North Carolina and other areas that have been hard hit by weather-related, you know, storms. So clearly valuable funding. It's so odd to me that Elon Musk, who doesn't know how government operates, is trying to dictate how we spend our money. I think I agree with you. I think he and Donald Trump are going to have a parting of the ways, and I think it's going to happen within the first few months.
Well, it's been suggested. People have seen he's like everywhere. He's right over his shoulder in the pictures at the Army-Navy game. There he was in the box.
Well, I don't think he's left Mar-a-Lago, right?
They've given him maybe they've given him the bathroom where all the documents were stored.
I'm not so sure. I understand why we think that might happen, but we do know that Trump really cozy ups to, respects, and wants to be part of anyone that's powerful. He really likes to be next to power. And he wants power, and he likes to be next to those that have power. Elon Musk does have an enormous amount of power. He is by far the wealthiest person on the planet. That in itself gives him an enormous amount of power. He owns communication systems that the Defense Department and our country, and even us just driving around in our cars, rely on every day. He is directly connected to the space industry, to the transportation industry. He has a lot of power, and he has already shown that he is willing to wage war with that power. And so if Trump threatens him with some type of threat of we're going to have to separate, I can see Elon Musk really retaliating in some way and using his leverage and all those different components in ways that might not be in the best interest of Trump or our country. I also think that it's important to remember that this is what Donald Trump does. He creates chaos. He loves to do this. Very much right now, I think what we're seeing is that he does not want Joe Biden or the Democratic Party to get credit for anything before he takes office. And so this is his way of trying to change the perspective, to make it look like he's doing something. So by saying, you can't do this, it forces them to go back and change something. They'll change something, and then Trump will say it's okay. And it won't really matter. Trump, it doesn't care about the details. He constantly says he doesn't care about the details. He just cares about the perception of who's in charge. So he wants to throw his power around. Possibly before the day's over, Trump will come back around and say, all right, well, the change has been made. I'm now happy with it. And it'll be something minor. I think that's probably what's going to happen.
I wonder why it came to this. In the sense that before Johnson agreed to whatever he agreed with the Democrats so that they had a bill to move forward, why didn't he or did he not
check
say
with
to
the
Trump,
teacher?
Yeah, say, talk yeah. to the boss. You're gonna, yeah. you know, don't embarrass me now. If you don't like it, we'll work on it. But if he didn't have the approval from Trump to begin with, why didn't he go to him to get that approval?
I don't think it works that way with Trump. Well, I mean, my understanding of based on how we've seen him work in the past is that even if he gives his approval, he still changes his mind. He can't be trusted. Any single person can say the right thing, especially on Fox News, can influence him and completely change his mind. So I think whatever back and forth they have, I don't think it's ever really a sealed deal until the final moment comes.
You know, there's a new poll out that says that Trump or Musk has a slightly higher favorability rating among Americans than Trump. So Trump's not going to like that. But the other thing is a large number of Americans do not like the idea that Musk is involved in running our government. So if Trump is a poll watcher, I know he challenges some polls, but if he's a poll watcher, that has to be a concern for him.
Letters. Here we go. When Musk became a citizen, he swore to obey U.S. law. Since then, he has violated labor law repeatedly. Deport him as an undesirable alien. That according to Sarah. We then go to Joan. Rand Paul has called for Elon Musk to be made Speaker of the House. Is the plan to weaken Johnson and install Musk? Well, I don't think that's a job that Elon Musk would want.
I hadn't thought of it, though. It's an interesting idea.
It is an interesting idea.
You know, it was really weak here is J.D. Vance. Like, where is he?
We talked about this last week on the show. We don't really know. When Teresa Bourgeois was here, she was talking about the work being done on Project 2025 and sort of seeing that elements of that through. That seems to be his
assignment?
Work,
oh, yeah.
His assignment. But he, you know, he isn't, he didn't get to go to the football game, that kind of stuff. All right, let's go to David. It seems to me that a shutdown would also stop the time-sensitive Democratic judicial nomination process in its tracks with only days left to accomplish it. Am I mistaken about this? And if not, is this part of the plan to force a shutdown?
I'm not sure how that works, actually.
And, well, I don't know how it affects the federal courts.
I don't think this shutdown plan is well thought out. Again, I don't think you can try to put any kind of logic or reason into it. It's Donald Trump reacting to something that he thinks is going to make him look bad. He doesn't understand the details. He doesn't care about the details. He just wants to make noise so he can say that I took credit for making it better, whatever that looks like.
So it's but again, TikTok, it's Friday is the deadline, and that's tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but I agree. I think you're onto something with the you come in. Trump comes in and says, I changed something. We don't know what that exactly that is. Everybody's happy, and then we move on.
We've seen him do this over and over and over again. He's going to come back and say, look, everybody's happy now because I came in and I fixed it. I fixed it. What would you have done if I hadn't have fixed it? Everybody loves me now.
I think it would be highly relevant, says Bob, to at least mention and discuss the implications of Musk's close connections and relationship with Putin. Well, we certainly have discussed it, and I think we've even discussed the connections between the president and Putin.
It is terrifying, to say the least.
You guys sound so cheery, said Julie.
Oh, he really? never met this person.
Yes. Yeah, you really ought to spend like 10 minutes with Ira.
Yeah, get the camera back in the studio. I'll frown for you for a while.
Oh, you don't have the camera anymore. It's gone.
No, we took that out. Oh, yeah. Okay. We're right back where we were in 2017, back with another Trump MAGA turmoil nightmare, though it's time. This time it feels much worse. Any tips on how the rest of us mere mortals can cope would be greatly appreciated. Well, I've described this before on the show, and I think I look at what we do now is just sort of collectively sitting in a circle, trying to take in as much information as we can, and every once in a while we'll gently put a hand on the person next to us and say, oh, I'm sure the cat will come back soon.
Well, I have a recommendation.
Like, that's sort of the best we've got, right?
I think that you want to be informed, and you should be informed. Wherever you're getting your information from, you should be informed. What I would recommend, though, is to not sit in front of the TV or with your phone in your hand watching every little nick and cranny of what's going on here, because it's going to drive you nuts. You should read your New York Times in the morning and then perhaps catch Lester Holt at 6 o'clock at night. But don't watch all day long, no matter which your cable choice is. Don't let yourself get so wound up in all of this.
Hey, Mr. Board Member, what about the radio station?
The radio station's the same.
Absolutely. You mean ex-board member.
Well, you know, I read 7 newspapers a day, and I get between
he's
online
bragging.
And...
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's true.
And I like to think I know what's going on, but I just admit that sometimes you just drive yourself crazy reading one story to the other.
I do think there's a difference between educating yourself, finding out what's going on, and then just poring over it. And my goodness, you know, and this is really, look, I listen to cable news at times, but there are points where it's just like, oh, my God, are we going to go into our fourth marathon hour talking about this? And there's nothing new, and it does get you all riled up. So
you got, you know, they're all more or less the same, but I tend to gravitate to CNN as the more neutral of the at least less not neutral.
As do I.
But you watch the CNN lineup at night, and each for 3 hours between Anderson Cooper, Caitlin Collins, and Abby Phillip, they all have panel discussions, and essentially they're changing the decks. Each panel has a different person, except the next night that one person may be with one of the other panels. And you're just regurgitating the same stuff over and over and over again. And if it wasn't
You know, people are going to say that that's what we do.
But if you listen to the roundtable for 2 hours in the morning and get this kind of discussion, fine. But don't immediately listen to somebody else doing the same thing. Or
I understand. Yeah. All right. We go to Susie. I live in South Carolina and have been approved for a SBA disaster relief loan. I was approved 2 months ago. I keep getting messages that they are awaiting funding from Congress. It angers me beyond belief that we are sitting in limbo. There are still so many houses with blue tarps over the roofs. Roadways are still littered with debris, and Elon Musk has a hand in deciding. We need help, and we need it now. That from Susie.
Well, this is where I think it is important to remember that even though we don't think of them this way, there are actually elected officials in Congress, many of them Republicans, that are in these districts where disasters happen, and they are seeing firsthand and hearing firsthand from their constituents about how desperate they are and how much they need this funding. And those individuals are going to the speaker and saying, look, we need to get this budget passed. My constituents need this. This is something that's really important. And so that conversation is happening. And ultimately, I think you're seeing that real conversation colliding with the egos of Musk and Trump, who just want to take credit for everything, even if they don't understand what's actually happening. You know, you got to remember that Donald Trump, let's just say it. He does not care about the people that are suffering in South Carolina. He doesn't care about the people that are suffering anywhere. He just cares about himself. So whatever decision he's making is what he thinks he needs to do to make himself feel better, to help make sure that he's stroking his own ego. It's not about the details of the people.
You know, we knew this deadline was coming up. Why are we waiting to the last minute to have this crucial discussion?
Well, it seems like we talk about this every 4 months.
Right. When we had when they came up with the last agreement, they said, yeah, the next deadline is going to be just around Christmas. And I thought to myself, well, then let's get on this right now. But no, we're waiting for the last
election
minute.
Election in the middle. Yeah.
Well, why do college students wait until the night before to write the term paper? I mean, it's just something that you tend to push off until the last second, and you've got that threat is hovering over you, and it motivates you more so than it would have 2 months ago.
You know, really good students and really good reporters and really good leaders get their stuff done ahead of time. So if there's a mistake, they can go over it and correct it and make it even better. So I know that there are some people who push deadlines.
Well, I think really good leaders is the key there. We don't have really good leaders right now in some key positions. And we have this one leader who isn't even in office yet, who has learned that if I wait till the last minute, that's when I can really create real chaos and get all the attention. So I think it's strategically timed on his part.
That was Terry Gibson on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, December 19th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. On Friday, December 20th, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Siena College professor of economics Aaron Pasitti, executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, and the mayor of the city of Albany, New York, Kathy Sheehan.
So the government shutdown looms as GOP rebels against Trump. So if you've been following the story for the week, they had a plan. The House GOP and Mike Johnson had a plan, and then they had a plan that would pass. And then Elon Musk and President-elect Trump said, "No, we don't want to do that plan." And then they came up with this new plan, and then that new plan then ticked off a lot of members, more conservative members of the House Republican ranks of the House Republicans, because it called for a raise in the debt ceiling. So now we're back to square one. TikTok, their government may shut down as of midnight tonight, really going into effect on Monday morning. Teresa, let us begin with you.
So actually, they had a four-way plan, which is they had an agreement with the Democrats in the House and Senate, and they were ready to go. And then Elon Musk, you know, the great legislator, who knows the budget?
The elected legislator.
Elected. Non-elected, non-nothing. I think it's fascinating, actually, because it really and then the president followed, blew up the deal, much like the president, the incoming president. I think this has really revealed a lot about the Republicans and their inability to govern. In fact, there was just a headline bulletin in the Washington Post that it appears that the Republicans may have reached a new deal amongst themselves, forgetting, of course, that they need to govern with the Democrats as well. But it looks like it pulls out the debt limit as it should, and it looks like it's pretty much what they had previous. I haven't read all the details, but it sounds like it's on par with the original four-way deal. I think that there is a lot that's revealed here, and the most important thing, I think, is the debt ceiling, that Trump is looking for a way to, let me back up. I mean, I think the Biden administration spent the last 4 years doing a lot of cleanup on the prior Trump administration because of their mishandling of the COVID and, in general, driving us deeply into debt. And I think what Trump was saying is basically, okay, you have to do a pre-clean so that I can do more of our taxes and more of the immigration spending that we don't have the ability to fund. And that's why he wanted them to raise the debt ceiling. And the Republicans and the Democrats aren't going along with that. The problem is that they claim that they're trying to save money. They're trying to save the taxpayers' money. That's what Musk and Trump say. But in fact, this is costing. You know, shutting down the government costs a lot of money. Not investing in these programs costs a lot of money. And they are just showing their hand very early that they really don't know how to govern. They know how to break things down, tear things down. They don't know how to govern.
I think you're missing a critical point, though, and that is probably since the late 90s with the Newt Gingrich House, Republicans have been explicitly Republicans don't want to govern. They want to make the government ineffective, right? They want to grind it to a standstill so that the government can't do what it's supposed to do, which is regulate and enact run-of-the-mill spending agreements that allow it to do what it does. Well, but elite and wealthy Republicans don't want that to happen because the money goes to middle class and poor people, not billionaires. So this is I think it's important to note that Republicans and Trump specifically, they do not gain political capital to increase their chances of reelection by passing legislative accomplishments. Mm-hmm. They gain political capital by engaging in public grievances and public fights that have no effect on the well-being of anyone, right? Like Matt Gaetz trying to oust McCarthy. You can call that a legislative achievement, but the gain for Gaetz was that he stole the spotlight. That's right. Republicans aren't trying to govern. They're trying to grind the government down so that it doesn't do what it's supposed to do, so that the elites can run the show. So they're not. I disagree with the Republicans are trying to govern and be public servants in the best interest of.
No, I don't think they're trying to. I think rhetorically they're trying to tear things down. I think that they think that the way to do it is to tear things down. But at the same time, the conservative Republicans from North Carolina, they want their disaster aid. Right.
Right. But I think that to this point, they do not want to govern. And so I think when we shift the language to say this is an example of the Republicans' failure to govern, we need to think about framing it as this is what happens when you have a party in power that does not want to govern, as opposed to a failure of their governance, in which case they'll point to the Democrats who didn't go along with them. They'll point and blame the Democrats. We need to make sure that people understand this is not a fiscally conservative party.
No.
This is not a party that is tax and spend. This is a party of borrow and spend. This is a party that wants to spend as much money as it can when it helps the elites. Mm-hmm. And that they, by design, do not want government to work. And so we have to attach, I think, and do a better job of attaching the right description of the language to what it is that's happening. This is what America is like when you have a party in charge that doesn't want government to work, as opposed to this is a party that can't govern. They're governing exactly the way they want to govern, which is in a way that departments do not get the aid out, right? You can't expect a different result. You can't say, well, we want government to work when it benefits a red state. This is what happens when you don't want government to work.
Well,
and I think that's what we have to hold their feet to the fire on.
They say we want less government, we want less government, we want less government. But they also say that we're going to help you. We're on your side. We're on your side. They say they denigrate the Republican, the Democrat, saying you want to defund the police, which was never the case. And at the same time, quietly, they're sitting appropriations bills that cut funding
right.
for frontline police programs like you run.
But they don't tell people that.
But
to the point is, they say we're going to help you, but you need to understand their way of saying that they're helping is by saying we're going to get rid of all this bureaucracy. We're going to get rid of all of these agencies because they're hurting you, not helping you. And there are many people who bought into that. I rode in an Uber. I was out at an anti-Semitism summit in California. I took an Uber to the airport, and my Uber driver, the person who benefits the most by the Affordable Care Act, by these safety nets that have been put in place, buys into the fact that these safety nets are hurting him, not helping him. And so I think that when we talk about it as far as what is the underlying cause. The underlying cause is that you have a party in power that does not want government to work and that fundamentally believes that if all these agencies went away, that the elites would be just fine and everyone else would just have to figure it out. And so that is their underlying premise. They really believe that if these agencies don't function, if you can't get your WIC benefits, you'll figure something out. And that's what we have to tell people. They don't want this to work. This is their fundamental, that they don't believe in the government that has been created and in the safety nets that have been created. So when they tell people they want to help them, what they're really saying is, we're going to blow it all up. We're going to take all of this away. And somehow these folks are going to be okay.
Well, what Trump wants to do is pass his tax cuts. Mm-hmm. Right. He wants to pass his tax cuts. That's why he's pressuring to raise the debt ceiling.
Sorry. I want to get to Nick.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a nuance in the concept that whether or not the conservative voters want government to work in so much as they don't think it's appropriate that government have this role in society of creating the social safety nets, of creating the oversight bodies. It's not a question of whether they want the government to work so much as should government be doing this activity. And when you put it into that context, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. These electeds can show that government is ineffective and inefficient by being in those positions and being ineffective and inefficient. And then they can say, and see, this is why government shouldn't be engaging in these activities in the first place. We're going to help by turning this back over to the private industries. And it's really the private industries that are efficient and effective because their bottom line is extracting wealth and generating wealth for the elites, if we want to call them that, or the, you know, the executives in those roles, because philosophically that's who deserves that wealth, right? Like, and I think that nuance is helpful in understanding why, you know, Matt Gaetz is more interested in getting the limelight than in governing, or why many of these folks are more interested in the show of it than in the action of passing legislation.
When you look at this, of the fact that 38 Republican lawmakers resisted Trump's support of spending and the debt deal, what does that say about the inner ranks? And I mean, to me, that just means that this could drag on for a really long time if we continually have that back and forth. You started off in saying, I mean, they.
I think that once you pull the debt limit off the table, many of those votes come back.
But is it Trump then going to go with if you take the debt limit off the table?
Right, because the reason Trump wants the debt limit off the table is to enact all of the things he talked about on the campaign trail. So if he gets those Republicans.
No, I'm sorry. I meant. When I say get it off the table, I mean that Trump is trying to get them to change the debt limit, right? Mm-hmm. To pass the debt, raise the debt limit now. They do
no,
not
No, he doesn't
want to
raise it. He wants it suspended.
Right. I'm sorry. He wants a change in the debt limit because he wants to be able to do two things. He wants to be able to reauthorize his tax breaks, mm-hmm. which generated enormous deficits, right? He owns 25% of our current debt is generated by him, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing he wants to do is this immigration, you know.
Border security. Borders,
well, I don't want to even call it border security. Let's not call it that. Let's call it what it is. Deport everyone.
It's violence is what it
and
is.
And you can't do that without spending an enormous amount of money. And he has to be able to fund that. And it's going to be costly. The process of it's going to be costly. And the implications of it because of rising food prices and other things, and construction prices, everything are going to be costly. So he wants a clear path to allow him to do that without it clearly.
And I think that, you know, that piece of it, and you have these 38 Republicans who say, well, wait a minute, we have been using the debt limit as a way of reining in the same type of spending by Democrats. And so this is, again, the filibuster question, right? If you blow it up, but then when you're in the minority and you need it, right? So this is the back and forth on that. So I get that. But to me, this is an example of exactly who Donald Trump is and has been. This man bankrupted seven companies.
Right.
He wants to spend other people's money to accomplish what he wants to accomplish for himself and his wealthy donors.
His oligarchs.
And his ability to stay in power and to be damned with what happens on the other side of that. This is how he has operated his businesses. When people call him a successful business person, somebody who I love dearly, a relative of mine, you know, recently said, well, he's a good businessman. Well, if you judge a good businessman by somebody who is willing to spend other people's money at exorbitant rates, not being able to explain how you're ever going to pay it back, and then when all things go to hell, you declare bankruptcy, well, then, yes, that is exactly what he is. But be clear, that is exactly what he is seeking to do. And the American people voted for him. And I think from the standpoint of being clear in our language, because I think Democrats are not clear in our language, we have to be very clear and say, yes, this is how you bankrupt a country. He bankrupted seven companies. This is how you bankrupt a country.
But haven't you seen those gold shoes? That's a successful business
But
move.
Don't you think that it was a good signal that these 30 people, 36 people would vote against him? I mean, I think
For how long? That I don't know, because I think, right, like the base that elected him is saying, this is what we want. This guy is going to somehow deliver. They don't believe that he's going to actually bankrupt our country. But I don't know. I have no evidence to the contrary. This guy has created debt for the 4 years that he was in office at an alarming rate. And I think he's going to do the same thing because he doesn't care about the future. He cares about benefiting himself and his wealthy donors. So my observation.
Let us talk more about this. And Aaron, I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about what a debt ceiling is, what it does, what it could do, and what we know about its implementation and its limitations.
Sure. This is not the most exciting thing to discuss, but remarkably important. So
you have 2 minutes to explain this incredibly complex thing. Yeah.
I have 2 minutes to explain what keeps the U.S. government
By the way,
functional.
The mayor's guy on watch.
Okay, you want me to
go?
Timer on? Let's see. Timer.
Give me a countdown. Okay. I need a countdown.
3, 2, 1.
There you go.
Only two countries in the world have a debt ceiling, and that's the United States and Denmark. And what a debt ceiling is, it's a second layer of bureaucracy that allows the government to fund what Congress has approved it to do. So Congress and the president pass a budget, right? That's the first legislative accomplishment. Then there's another layer, which is that Congress then has to authorize the Treasury Department to issue enough bonds to cover the spending initiatives. So, you know, Congress can pass a budget that says we're going to do X, Y, and Z. But if the Treasury's not authorized to provide the money to fund that, off to the races, huh?
Yeah, we're off to the races.
Sorry. I get a 10-second extension
going
for that. So Congress has to authorize the Treasury Department to create enough money to allow Congress to spend what it's already agreed to spend. So it's a preposterous idea. It has its roots in World War I. The debt ceiling should be abolished. It is ludicrous to have a debt ceiling in a modern economy. But politicians have found it remarkably convenient as a bargaining chip and leverage to negotiate over different type of spending policies they want. So politicians realize that, one, the debt ceiling is stupid, because if Congress passes a budget, then that's the budget. That's what the government should be spending. Having to agree to a separate piece of legislation that allows the Treasury Department to enable that is just nonsense. So the way the Treasury Department does that is by issuing bonds, where the government borrows money from the public to raise money to fund its current spending initiatives, and then we have to pay those people back in the long run. So there's an important point with that, and that is that if the debt ceiling is not raised, Not only can the government not make payments for certain essential services and programs that it's enacted, it can't pay.
Get a count, Dad. You're in overtime.
All right,
that's
I'm in overtime.
Right.
So not only if the debt ceiling is not increased, then what that means is that the government can't make payments on things that Congress has already authorized. In addition to that, and the more important, so that's going to affect the public in terms of getting social services, having, you know, functioning TSA lines at the airport during the holiday travel season and so on. The more important thing in terms of the macroeconomic picture is that the government won't be able to pay interest to bondholders, which means the government is in default. And when the largest economy in the history of world civilization defaults on its promises to bondholders, then we could experience a global financial crisis, the likes of which we probably have not seen since really the 1930s.
That was Aaron Pasitti on the Roundtable panel on Friday, December 20th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.